Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Each week, we choose an interesting new book on some area of sports, and we interview the author. This week, my guest is political scientist Jennifer Ring. We are discussing her book, Stolen Bases: Why American Girls Don't Play Baseball, published by the University of Illinois Press. For the last 4 years, I've coached a team for my local Little League Baseball Association. For a couple of those years, two of the players on my team were girls, my daughter, and another girl named Maria. Overall, the girls enjoyed being part of a team of boys, and I appreciated having them on the team. My daughter was a dependable catcher and first baseman, while Maria was the engine of the offense. In one season, she had a batting average of 800, and with her fast, smart, and aggressive running, she was a threat to score every time she got on base. But despite my naive belief that baseball was finally open to girls, and despite the declared openness of the league, there were episodes which showed me that girls playing baseball was still something unusual, even something frowned upon. For example, when signing up my daughter for the league, the online registration site automatically placed her in the local softball league when I marked her gender as female. Only after calls to league officials was she switched to baseball. Maria, meanwhile, was the first girl in league history to earn a coveted spot on the All-Star team. But in the team's games, Maria was played for only one inning, and then she was put on the bench. Despite her ability at the plate and on the bases, she was the only player on the team to get the required minimum amount of playing time in every game. Jenny Ring's daughter had similar experiences in her baseball career. From Little League up to high school, she endured slights from coaches, players, and parents, as well as explicit opposition to her playing. These experiences led Jenny, as a scholar, to ask the question, why is it that girls can't play baseball? As she discovered in her research, and as we talk about in the interview, the history of baseball reveals a purposeful exclusion of girls. And even though the expansion of athletics in the last four decades has opened a wide range of sports to girls and women, baseball in America remains closed. Jenny's findings were eye-opening. And based on my own experience in youth baseball, I found myself agreeing with much of what she said. I enjoyed our conversation about the book, so let's turn to the interview. Jenny, welcome to New Books in Sports. Thank you for joining me today.
It's a pleasure, Bruce.
So I'll ask you first to introduce yourself. You're a political scientist by training. Can you tell us a bit about your academic background and some of the work that you've done?
Well, I'm a political scientist. I was got my undergraduate degree at UCLA and my master's and doctorate degree from Berkeley in the 70s. Have taught at several places. I'm actually trained as a political theorist and was also invited after I finished my degree in Berkeley to begin teaching courses there on women in politics and race and gender in politics. And I think it was because I was available and it was a new field at that point. And it certainly opened my eyes to an area of study that as a classically trained political theorist from Berkeley or, you know, traditionally trained, I didn't know about. And I've been teaching American politics, women in politics, race and gender in politics, along with traditional political philosophy at various places at Berkeley and Stanford for a while. And then I received tenure from the University of South Carolina and came back to the University of Nevada, Reno, to begin a women's studies program here. And I've been here for about 15 years. I started the program and then returned to the political science department.
And you're also a great baseball fan as well.
Yes, that predates any academic training.
So one thing I liked about your book from the start is that in the acknowledgement section, you identify not only your own fan allegiance, but also the favorite team of just about every other person you thanked for the in helping with the book, which gave me the sense as a reader from that section that this was a book motivated by a love of baseball.
Yes, this was a book of the heart from start to finish. I think I began writing it when my younger daughter, who is an athlete and a baseball lover and just has been from the time she was about 3 years old. I mention in the book that I think there's some kind of baseball gene and you either have it or you don't have it. And if you have it, it's hard to explain to people who don't have it. But it's the love of the game is something just primal. And so my younger daughter and my husband, I guess, you know, the strange thing is that my older girl likes baseball, but really, you know, isn't that involved. And the younger one just wanted to play baseball from the time she was about 3 years old. And she played in the Little League. She's both a natural, you know, gifted ball player and a hard worker and willing to be coached. And she ran into trouble after Little League when she was facing tremendous cultural pressure to switch to softball, and she didn't want to. And by the time she was getting ready to try out for the freshman team at her high school, I was looking at what she was facing and the kind of discouragement and the pressure from parents and coaches and not her teammates, not the boys she was playing with, but, you know, how is it that she's still the only girl, still, meaning that I was also, I grew up at a time before girls even were allowed into Little League. It was before the 1973 lawsuits. So here's my kid, you know, more than three decades later, and she's having the same trouble staying in the game past Little League. And so I began writing at that point because I was outraged and protective, and as someone with the baseball gene myself and recognizing it in her, I couldn't explain why in an age when women's equality has made such strides, it isn't complete yet, but it's certainly different than when I was growing up, and after Title IX is passed, why it's still so difficult for a girl to play the national pastime and to take it seriously and to move beyond just kind of childish recreational play. And she wanted to be a high school player. She wanted to take it as far as she could. So that's when I began writing the book, when she was facing her real opposition. There's no other word to say it. I mean, she was facing social and cultural opposition to the idea of her playing baseball, which it seemed incredible to me.
So with the experience of your daughter, you came to realize that there is this deliberate exclusion of girls and women from baseball. And then much of the book is devoted to this question of why. Why are girls today excluded from the game as they reach higher levels of competition? And why in your day were girls excluded entirely from organized baseball?
Yes.
And so you begin with history to find out if this was always the case. And so I want to start here. And I was surprised to read that this was not always the case, that girls and women regularly played baseball in the 19th and into the early 20th centuries.
Yes, they did. And even before that, I mean, that's in the United States, certainly. I mean, there's kind of a scholarly agreement that baseball, or the earliest forms of it, was a girls' game in England. And it was, you know, there were a number of different versions of it, kind of localized versions. It was called rounders. It was called baseball. There was an early version called stool ball that was apparently invented by milkmaids in their time between milkings, you know, where they're bored and they don't have anything to do, and they put their milking stools in a circle, and one stood in the middle and served or pitched either a cricket ball or a rock sometimes at one of the other girls, who would hit it with a stick or a rolling pin or, you know, something, and run around the bases, and the fielders would attempt to get her out by throwing the rock or the cricket ball at her as she ran. So, you know, I mean, it's not exactly a delicate feminine sport for little milkmaids. And so there were predecessors. I mean, there's plenty of evidence that girls spontaneously came to the game that we now know as baseball, and that when baseball first arrived on American shores, which was long before this myth of Abner Doubleday drawing a baseball diamond in a dirt field with a stick, girls and boys and love, they just responded to this new game that emerged. And there's not a clear moment when baseball was invented in the United States. It probably emerged because there were English immigrants here who brought it with them. Or it's the kind of game that kids will make up. It's, you know, it's not that complicated. But it evolved, and by the middle of the 19th century, it was being played by everybody who could play it, you know, all races, all classes, all genders. Girls played, boys played. So, yeah, I argue in the book that basically girls and women had to be shoved off America's diamonds. They were already there. And, it took some doing to get them off, and I discuss the reasons for that in the book.
Yeah, and that's what I'm going to ask next, because looking at the history of women's exclusion from the game, it wasn't a gradual process. It was, like you say, a shoving off. In many instances, women and girls were banned from playing baseball quite deliberately and quite explicitly.
Yes, and it was, you know, they would get shoved off and they would come back. I mean, they wouldn't stay gone, which, you know, shows you something about the love of the game or the baseball gene or whatever, you know, we're calling it. I associate it, you know, the kind of official exclusion of baseball is a manly game with kind of growing nationalism in the late 19th century and the professionalism, the changing economy of the United States. So, and I associate it explicitly. He wasn't completely responsible for this, but I think he articulated it. Albert Goodwill Spaulding, the sporting goods magnate, and he was a very gifted pitcher for the Boston Red Stockings and the Chicago White Stockings, and was instrumental in organizing the National League and basically professionalizing baseball and exporting it and taking a tour of American baseball players around the world at, in 1897, basically to places in the old British Empire, to try to, I think, drum up business for a sporting goods company, but also, you know, as a way of kind of colonizing undeveloped nations with men of color, and showing them that this was the way to become civilized. And, you know, here was an orderly, rational, civilized, utterly American game. And Spaulding became quite fanatic at claiming that the game was a natural American game, indigenous to American soil, invented by American boys, and denying that there was any connection with anything English, and certainly with anything feminine. So there was actually an incident when his traveling team returned to a victorious dinner at Delmonico's in New York to celebrate this exportation of the American game of baseball. There was a banquet, and Theodore Roosevelt was there, Mark Twain was there, was star-studded, no women, of course. And somebody, actually Henry Chadwick, who was an early figure, an Englishman who was an early figure in bringing actually developing the game of baseball in the United States. He had immigrated from England. And he said, you know, baseball is related to rounders. He said that out loud at this banquet. And there was an uproar. You know, I think by then the guys had had a few drinks in them, you know, and they were, it was a, you know, a boisterous, happy affair. And they started banging on the tables and saying, no rounders, no rounders, no rounders. And, you know, it was horrifying that somebody could actually associate the American game with an English game, much less an English girls' game. So at that point, I think Spalding thought that he really wanted to come up with an official history of the American game. The game was getting claimed as America's national pastime. It was getting professionalized. There was money involved. So you weren't going to have America's national sport be associated with femininity in any way. And he put together a commission and basically told them what to write, and they came up with this myth of Abner Doubleday, who was inventing this game. He was at that point a war hero from the Civil War and the Mexican War, so he was sufficiently manly. He was a general, and they gave him credit for inventing the game. And he later said he had nothing to do with it at all. He'd never even played baseball.
So in looking at, I want to go back to the early 20th century, and you have some great anecdotes about, particularly at colleges and universities, where these women would be playing on the green, and the university officials would shut down the girls' team. And so you mentioned Spalding, and Spalding stated explicitly that baseball was a game for building manliness. But when these university officials and others excluded or banned girls from playing baseball, they typically cited health reasons, correct?
Yes. Yeah, well, yeah. There's some hilarious stuff, actually. I think you might be referring to there was one game in 1904 at the University of Pennsylvania, and it was a pickup game of co-eds, men and women, undergrads, playing in the university quad surrounded by faculty offices and administrative offices. And here are these adults in their offices, men, obviously, because the women, were not in that position at that time. And they hear this uproar from out in the quad, and it's that a girl on one of the teams, they were mixed teams, got the best hit of the game, a game-winning double, and there was bedlam. All the students were, ecstatic, as only 20-year-olds can be, when something like that happens. They're yelling and screaming and cheering, and, this girl had hit the ball further than anyone else. And the university officials came down, and they banned women from playing baseball at the University of Pennsylvania, and they told the men that they could no longer play on the quad, they would have to play on the athletic fields. So, the moment when it's clear that girls can play or that women can play is often the moment when, the long arm of the law comes crashing down. So I try to figure out what was so problematic about that they had to ban women from baseball. And I think maybe at that point it had to do with the kind of scandal of seeing young men and women playing together and being exuberant together. I think that maybe seemed a little promiscuous or something, that was something that shouldn't be allowed to happen. Later on, maybe you're thinking of the Little League lawsuits. There's a chapter in the book about 1973 when girls sued. One girl specifically was the first, although that's been contested too. But there were several lawsuits, and Maria Pepe was a 10-year-old who had been playing Little League. And her team, her coach, her team, her community didn't, she was doing just fine. And then Little League Baseball Central Office got wind of it and said that they would close down the charter for that particular high school, Hoboken, New Jersey, if they didn't get the girl off the team. There were no girls allowed in Little League Baseball. And in Little League's charter, it explicitly stated that Little League existed to build the qualities of citizenship, sportsmanship, and manliness. And so it wasn't for girls, and that no girls were allowed. So the National Organization of Women took up the cause. This was right after Title IX passed, but before enforcements were in place. And they actually had to use the 14th Amendment rather than Title IX, but they won the lawsuit. But in the meantime, the arguments that Little League Baseball came up with to justify excluding all girls from playing baseball with boys were that girls' bones would break more easily than boys, and the boys were obviously going to break the girls' bones playing baseball. The argument was that baseball was a contact sport. That's since been thrown out. Medical experts were brought in by both sides, but the experts from Little League Baseball actually worked for the Philadelphia 76ers, and he said there's no evidence that girls 8 to 12 have bones that break any quicker than boys who are 8 to 12, and in fact, if anything, they're more flexible. There was an argument made by Little League Baseball, Little League Baseball was using a kind of suspicious study for that. It was some study that had been done, my God, I say this and it's so hard to believe, on Japanese cadavers, ages 8 to 80. And that was, you know, the evidence they used to show that, girls' bones broke more easily. There was another argument they made that girls would get breast cancer from, and they put this, it was not too delicately, they said girls would get breast cancer from getting tagged out in the boobs. And that was a serious argument in this court case to exclude girls from baseball. The arguments were just extraordinary. The coaches would all be men, it was assumed. And if a girl got injured, a coach might have to rub a girl's leg to make her feel better, and that would be unseemly. Or if she got hurt in the chest, he might have to unbutton her jersey. I mean, there were these extravagant reasons why basically girls couldn't play because it would inconvenience the men who were coaching them. They couldn't pat them on the rear when they made a good play, which, of course, assumed that they might make a good play. So when you look at the Little League lawsuits, you know that something's going on besides science, you know, to keep girls out of baseball.
Mm-hmm. I want to make a detour here, which is a detour you make in the book, and ask about the origins of softball. And where did softball come from, and how did that sport become the standard accepted option for girls and women who wanted to play a bat and ball game?
Yeah, that game was invented by men in right about the same time, two kind of parallel moments of birth. One was in Chicago at the Farragut Boat Club. It was a group of young men who had gathered, I think young professional guys, and they had a ticker tape in the gymnasium of the Farragut Yacht Club, and it was Thanksgiving, and they were gathering to hear the Harvard-Yale football game. And some were from Harvard and some were from Yale, but they were all good friends, and so they listened to the game, and I can't remember who won, I think Harvard. And this was 1897, and in the kind of boisterous horseplay after the game was over, one grabbed a boxing glove that was in the gym and threw it at another guy who grabbed a broomstick that was leaning up against the wall and swatted it away. And that was so much fun that they tied the boxing glove up in its own laces and made a kind of a soft ball out of it and started playing indoor baseball, they called it, and enjoyed it so much that one of them volunteered to write up a set of rules for indoor baseball. And it soon became, they loved the game. It was clearly a lot of fun, and it would enable them to play baseball indoors during these cold winter months. And it kind of moved outdoors in the springtime, but they wanted to make sure that the game was not to be confused with real baseball, the manly sport, the national pastime. So they called it games like Nancy Ball, Sissy Ball, Panty Waist, games so that nobody would mistake it for the masculine version of the game. And yet it was clear they loved it, and it let them play indoors. And actually, at just about the same time in Minneapolis, the fire chief named Charles Robert was trying to keep his men fit during the winter months, and they were sick of calisthenics and medicine balls. And so he invented a similar game that would keep them moving indoors during the Minneapolis winters. And it was a game that caught on as a way to play baseball in the off season. I think maybe it was, because there were softer balls and smaller bats, and, the game was designed so you wouldn't break out the windows of the gym you were playing in. And it was given these kind of sexually derogatory, feminized nicknames. And this was an era at the turn of the century, the early part of the 20th century, where educators were getting the idea that maybe girls needed some exercise after all, and they were trying to come up with exercise plans in school for girls. And softball seemed like a natural kind of a substitute for baseball, which was becoming entrenched in its masculinity. Softball was kind of assigned to girls as girls' baseball.
So if I can make another detour, following another thread you follow in the book, the exclusion of women from baseball in the United States really stands out when you look at baseball played in other countries, and also the related sport, cricket, in England. So could you talk about women in baseball and women in cricket elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, what was odd is that, here America proudly claims, even though it's not exactly true, but claims to be the birthplace of baseball, and certainly made it its national sport, and it was the first professional sport in the United States. So, there are claims that can be made for the association of baseball with national identity. And, that to me is what was so puzzling, which is, why exclude half the nation from a sport that you claim is your national sport, unless you're afraid of your nationhood being associated with femininity. But there is in the United States no infrastructure. I mean, this is what my daughter's story, and it's not unique. It's not nearly as exceptional as you'd think. Of girls wanting to play baseball, and because there is no girls' baseball in the United States, and even after the Little League lawsuits, Maria Pepe, who was the first plaintiff, was too old to play by the time she won the lawsuit. Little League Baseball could have, and I guess I didn't mention this when we were talking about Little League earlier, except to say what their ridiculous arguments to keep girls out were. When they lost, there were any number of options that they could have come up with. One is just to graciously let the girls who wanted to play with the boys play with the boys. And if they weren't good enough, they weren't good enough. That's kind of the American way, laissez-faire, right? If you can't cut it, it's a kind of self-selection process. But they shut down the New Jersey Little League rather than let girls play in it, which is extraordinary. For a whole year, no boys in New Jersey got Little League baseball either. And then they came back with Little League softball instead of Little League baseball. And essentially, softball was at that point institutionalized. In the 1970s, instead of now that it was legal for girls to play baseball, instead of either allowing girls to play with boys or organizing girls' baseball, you know, a separate development system for girls, they invented, or they didn't invent, they imposed or recommended Little League softball instead. And so there never has been a structure for Little League baseball in this country. And girls who want to play basically have to find a boys' team to play on, and some girls don't want to play with boys. Some do, but they don't have the option. They don't have the choice. And there is an international women's baseball circuit, and the United States fields a team, the U.S. women's national team, which is sponsored by USA Baseball in North Carolina, just as it sponsors the USA men's national teams. I'm writing a new book about this, this kind of follow-up to Stolen Bases is about this national team that nobody knows about. And the question is where they come from, because there is no women's baseball in the United States except for these girls who are scrambling to play with boys or men. And other countries that regularly send teams, the kind of powerhouse countries of the international women's baseball circuit, are Japan, Australia, and Canada, basically, and the United States. There are also countries that come from Cuba, from Venezuela, from Puerto Rico, from the Netherlands, from India, from Chinese Taipei, Hong Kong, Korea. So there are all these baseball teams around the world that nobody knows about. And the top three, Japan, Australia, and Canada, with the United States usually up there battling, you don't know how, but I know how, because I've seen my daughter battle to stay in the game, and she's a member of Team USA. The other countries have women's baseball and girls' baseball. Japan has Girls Little League and baseball for girls in school. And then actually two teams, an A team and a B team. And they get them together, they form a national team, and they play together all year round. So they are very difficult to beat. They're, as the American girls call them, the Japanese machine. They're just fantastic baseball players. Canada has a system where the girls can play on their own teams or on men's teams. Australia has boys and girls playing together up until they're age 14, and then after age 14 they have a system of girls baseball and boys baseball. They separate them out when they get to be teenagers, probably because the size difference matters most at that point. So here are these other countries that actually support girls and women's baseball, and here's the United States claiming it's their game, and there's no place for girls to go. I mean, it is a lifelong struggle, if you've got the baseball gene, to find a team to play on if you're a girl. Now, you know, how do you account for that, apart from some kind of national psychosis? I think it's because baseball is associated with national identity. And so you asked about cricket. Women in England have been battling to play cricket also, and that may be, you know, they may have a struggle to play cricket because cricket is England's national game, at least, you know, according to many. But nonetheless, there are laws in England that obligate local communities that support a cricket club to have a women's cricket club if they have a men's cricket club. So, you know, in some ways, the exclusion of American girls from baseball is an exception in world sports. I mean, it just stands out as something that seems to me so kind of culturally and emotionally suspicious. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So in looking at American baseball as unique relative to other countries that play baseball, and then in looking at sports, in particular youth sports, university and high school sports today, where you have increasing participation by girls and college women in a variety of different sports, is baseball becoming even more exclusive in the sense that you see fewer and fewer young black men playing baseball, and more exclusive in a class sense? And you talk about this in the book of how baseball is becoming privatized, only those who can afford the lessons and the elite leagues and so forth are able to advance in baseball. So I guess the question for you is baseball becoming once again a white sport and a white rich sport?
You know, I would say it's in danger of becoming that way. It may not be, it might not be that, I'm not sure that baseball is absolutely unique. I mean, the privatization of youth sports is, you know, it's a development that I don't like. The idea that, and I think a number of scholars have done important work on this, being critical of tracking kids at a very early age into one sport and getting them those private lessons. So it's, you know, it's not just something that characterizes baseball, although I think that the demographics for baseball, seem to be just tenaciously white, male, and wealthy. I think that is a description that's a problem. I don't think baseball wants it to be that way, but it is. And yet, this notion of the privatization of youth sports and the kind of pre-professionalization, the notion that if you are, 12 years old and haven't had a private coach and been playing on tournament teams, it's almost too late for you in almost any sport. And there's a kind of a different track, I think, for sports that are more associated with poorer demographics, with poverty. Basketball, I think, has its way of reaching out to poor kids and developing them at a very early age. So you get, these kids who are being drafted by the pros when they're 18 or 19 or 15, offered multimillion-dollar contracts. Now, that doesn't seem to happen with the girls. So, I'm kind of rambling myself here, I guess, trying to find, an accurate answer, which is that on the one hand, I regret this kind of privatization and professionalization of youth sports in general, of not letting kids play. And that may be part of the problem that continues to exclude girls. I mean, there's always this argument that people won't pay to see girls play baseball. I mean, who cares? Although, it would be nice if there was public interest. But the idea that you're going to exclude an 8-year-old girl from playing baseball because there's no professional reward for her down the line is, to me, a really kind of distorted value system.
So I want to go back to your first chapter when you talk about your daughter's experiences. And I have to say, once again, having coached Little League Baseball, that the descriptions you have of the behavior of the dads and the coaches in Little League Baseball was just spot on. You just nailed your descriptions of these dads behind the backstop yelling instructions at their sons. And I want to ask you, you've kind of hinted at this earlier, but I want to ask you directly, did you find in your research and also in your daughter's experience that it's the dads in the dugout who are the coaches and the dads in the bleachers who most oppose a girl playing baseball as opposed to the boys on the field?
Yeah, definitely. there's no question. The trouble that my daughter encountered, the resistance that she encountered. There were some, and this is not universal, you know, I mean, because there were also some men in the Little League who saw her talent and were, you know, gentlemen at the younger levels anyway. I think the real trouble begins kind of after Little League, at that 12 to 15-year-old Babe Ruth league, where they're all getting, the boys are getting prepped for high school, and the dads are absolutely committed to their sons' future careers in baseball and high school and college and professional. I don't, you know, most of them are fantasies because, you know, how many men make it that far? But, you know, the prepping for the high school is where things got very serious. So in Little League, there were, you know, there were dads that could appreciate her talent. I remember one at bat where it was a kid who was probably the best pitcher in the league. He had he was the stud. He was, the guy, the boy every other boy wanted to get a hit off of. And he was very good and self-possessed and poised. And you know, this is when I think Lily was 10 or 11 years old. And it was one of those at-bats, where he kept throwing strikes and she kept fouling them off. And I think there were, 14 or 15 pitches in that at-bat. And, you know, and people were gathering from the other diamonds, you know, to see this at-bat, which was going on forever. And finally, she got a hit off him, you know, so she prevailed during that at-bat. And, hit a ball through past the second baseman, and she runs down to first base, and she's just sitting there with the biggest grin on her face you could imagine. And the dads who had come by to watch the spectacle were laughing and congratulating me and just saying, great at bat, Lily. So it's, you know, it's not that, you know, all dads are out to get little girls off baseball diamonds, although I think some of them are. I think that they were, you know, they had affection for her. She's a sweet kid, you know, as you know, a lot of girls are. When they're on a baseball diamond, they're good baseball players, but, you know, there's that, you have to be kind of a gritty, admirable girl to hang in there with, you know, all these boys. So I think they had affection and respect for her. I think they just all expected that she would, you know, that she was gonna a serious future softball player, and that's why she was sticking with Little League baseball. And it was really after Little League that it was very clear that one man came up to me and my husband were standing in the stands, and Lily had done something good. This was at the Babe Ruth level. It just made a good play or a good hit or something. And he came up and he said, you know, she should be playing softball. And we're going, she just did great at baseball. Why are you telling us this? And it was like, you know, she shouldn't be wasting her talent with boys. And I think my husband said she liked baseball. And look at, you know, look at what she just did. Mm-hmm. And this man literally looked at him and said, no girl will play baseball in this town, not so long as I live here. Oh, and, right. It was pretty explicit at that point. And, I think the boys, the boys are more democratic. She's out there. They know her. She's in the dugout with them. And they know what she can do. And if she's making hits and getting safely on base and catching the ball and throwing the ball, they're okay with it. But it was the parents, particularly the dads. There was another good story when she was playing high school baseball, when we transferred, and switched to that poorer high school with the academic magnet program, and the coach, she was a left-hander, and the coach of that team taught her how to pitch. She had never pitched. That was a position reserved for coaches' sons in the Little League. And she developed, you know, he taught her, she developed a good, good curveball and a good changeup, and she, you know, had good control. So she was a good off-speed pitcher. And the high school team at that point had a couple of starters that could throw in the upper 80s and low 90s, and they had professionals, scouts out there with speed guns watching them during their senior year. And the high school coach was real smart. He'd put one of these two guys in, Jake or Jeremy, and then after a couple of innings, he'd bring Lily in as the middle reliever. And, you know, while these guys were throwing heat, 90 miles an hour, Lily comes in and throws off-speed stuff. And she would just, 30 miles an hour slower, she'd have the batters on the other team twisted up in knots. And so Lily struck out this kid who had been, was one of the privileged kids on the opposing team. I think our coach said that his parents had spent $60,000 in private lessons for him. And he gets up there and Lily strikes him out. And it was on the evening news. I kind of felt bad for the kid, actually. And the mother was so appalled that she followed Lily to the team bus. And Lily looks, there's this woman following her. And as Lily's about to get on the bus, she says, like, what? And the woman says, you struck out my son. And Lily's teammates are laughing. And Lily just said, I'm sorry? She wasn't sure, how to respond. And the kid got so kind of, it was in his head that this girl had struck him out, that he insisted, told his coach he wanted to face her the next time she pitched, and she struck him out again. So, I think it's at that kind of adolescent level where it's the parental resistance. Although, I have to say, there were plenty of moms that came up to me and just said, good for Lily. I so admire her. And my younger daughter, Jake's young sister, and Jake was on the baseball team, so admires Lily. And it was real important that Lily hung in there. And I think that a lot of the adult women in the community, recognize that. And not so many men.
So the man who came up to you and your husband in the stands, and then dads you describe behind the backstop, these would be examples of, I guess you would say, men behaving badly. And and so these would be the men, in the case at the game in the stands, these are the men who perpetuate and maintain the exclusion of girls from baseball. And I want to ask, get around really to the big question that we've been coming to throughout the interview. Why are they doing that? And I want to throw in a wrinkle. Mm-hmm. Thinking of, in coaching, I've encountered these dads at the field. And many of these dads also have daughters. And the daughters might play soccer. They might play lacrosse. In my area, girls water polo is becoming a popular high school sport. At colleges across the country, women's rugby teams are gaining popularity. So these are all rough, dangerous sports with a lot of injuries, but it's accepted that girls can play them, but girls can't play baseball. And so coming back to this question, what do you think is going on? What is it that with this dad behind the backstop that he'll allow his daughter to play lacrosse, mm-hmm. but he won't allow his daughter to play baseball?
Okay, let me throw out a few thoughts about that. One thought, although it's kind of intangible, but I do kind of follow this line of argument throughout my book, is that baseball is in some way sacred in a way that other sports aren't. It's special. Mm-hmm. And I know, we love football now and the Super Bowl is, the biggest draw in the history of the world, on Super Bowl Sunday. But I would still argue that historically speaking, there's a kind of an emotional connection with American history and baseball. And that its association with national identity has been associated with American boyhood and manhood, and so there's a kind of an emotional tie maybe that men aren't willing to share, I say that not as though they're like malicious or something, just some kind of deep You know, we talk about sons and fathers and this kind of sacred bond of, you know, the dad taking his son out to play catch with him when he gets of a certain age. And sometimes I think of, you know, me playing catch. I mean, here I am, a frustrated baseball player who never got as far as Little League. And I've got this daughter who loves baseball, and, you know, I've been playing catch with her all her life. And I think, gosh, sometimes I think, we must look a little strange, you know. I mean, here we are doing the father-son thing, only we're the mother and the daughter. And it's not even, you know, her father and her. So, you know, there's some kind of, I think, deep emotional association with boyhood and manhood. And, you know, I think that maybe gets in the way. And to that, I just want to say, okay, can we get over it? You know, I mean, can we move on? And there is room for mothers and daughters in baseball, as long, you know, as well as fathers and sons, and it's family values and American history and culture, and why not include the girls and the women, because women have loved baseball all along. So that's one thing that I think contributes to the persistence of excluding girls. The other thing, and that's the whole idea of sex segregation in sports. The idea that we, as a nation and a culture, and maybe it's universal, but it's almost like adhering to some Victorian ideal of separate spheres. We let girls play sports now, but the assumption is that they're not going to be as good as boys, and so they need to stay in their own segregated arenas. So that, you know, it's not that a girl who plays water polo or lacrosse or basketball or soccer might be interested in and good enough to play with boys. And the good enough part, I think, doesn't necessarily have to do with size or muscle mass or body type, although it might, but I don't think that the scientific evidence is in on that. You know, I think, to me, it has a lot to do with culture and nurturance, and the fact that when a little boy is born, whether or not he's got what it takes to be an athlete, the disposition, the body, the temperament, he's going to get some stuff on his little pajamas and in his baby room that you know, he's getting baseballs and footballs and basketballs and soccer balls, whether he wants them or not. You know, and it's up to him to say, Mom, Dad, I'm just not interested. And girls don't get that. You know, a girl has to say, I want to play. I want to play. And then even if, you know, if the mother or the father is athletic and wants to encourage their daughters from an early age to play a sport, you know, culturally it's just not that kind of encouragement. And so I think girls have some catching up to do, you know, as a whole. But the notion that no girl should be playing with boys is to me that's problematic. To me, we'd be a healthier nation if we let our kids play together and learn to see that not every boy is a better athlete than every girl. Now, taking that one step further to baseball specifically, because I think baseball is a part of the problem. Where we don't want to see boys and girls competing against each other. And we say it's because the boys are going to hurt the girls. But my sneaking suspicion is because we're afraid the girls might be better than the boys. Mm-hmm. And with baseball specifically, because I think baseball is the only sport, you know, there's some differences. There are differences in the rules in girls and women's lacrosse and men's lacrosse, and basketball used to be more dramatic. But, you know, there are some differences. But baseball, it's not only sex segregated, it's sports segregated. You know, there's one version, softball, which is girls' baseball. And if you ask anybody off the street, that's, you know, why, what's softball? Well, it's girls' baseball, you know, half of them will say. Or why don't girls play baseball? Well, they get softball. So we segregate them. And my sense about that is it's this double segregation. You know, on the one hand, they're not supposed to play with boys, and on the other hand, they're not even supposed to play the sport that that we reserve for boys and men in this country. And my hunch is that baseball is not a contact sport and is not as dependent on size for excellence. And so, in fact, maybe the girls could outplay the boys, and that's, I think, people are very fearful of that. We, as a culture, have a lot invested in the notion that at least physically in sports, boys and men are supposed to be better than girls and women. And if we let girls into the baseball game, they might prove that that's not the case. And I think as a culture, we don't want to see that.
So we're almost out of time, and I want to ask you, you've mentioned you're working on the new book about the women who play on the U.S. Women's National Baseball Team, which your daughter also plays on. And I want to ask, with the interviews that you've done with these players, do these women have a sense that they're building something? Are they hopeful that in the future there will be more opportunities for girls to play baseball?
Yeah, I think that it's such a, you know, you'd think, when I started off doing my research for this book, I thought, oh boy, I don't want to write a depressing book about women who have battled. You know? It's like, excuse me, could you, I'm sorry, could you tell me your horror story, could you? You know, and that wasn't the book I wanted to write. And luckily, when I start talking to these women, many of whom I've gotten to know through my daughter's involvement with the U.S. Women's National Team, Team USA, you know, they're great young women. They're smart. They're, you know, they have to be. They can't get paid for playing baseball. They all have to get an education, you know, and so they're a remarkably articulate, upbeat group. They're a happy gang of spectacular athletes, and they really range in age. There are teenagers who are still playing high school baseball. There are college women, fewer of them play. There are very, very few women who make it to play college ball. But many of the women in their teens and early 20s, or, you know, who are not yet done with college, are hopeful about that. And the high school players, I think many of them really want to play baseball in college. The women in their 20s, in their, you know, kind of athletic primes, 20s and early 30s, are just love the game and are happy to just be playing. And there's some veterans of the Silver Bullets, the oldest members of Team USA, are now in their mid to late 20s. And I think one expressed a little bit of jealousy that the younger players had more of a chance to really go further with baseball than she did. But, you know, I think, and the ones that age, I always ask them the question, do you think that if you were a man, would you be playing professional baseball? And each one of them, not a moment's hesitation, they say, well, I sure hope so. Yeah, I think so. You know, and I've talked to some of them that have actually retired and are now coaching with USA Baseball. And so, yeah, I think that they're, I should say that they love the game. Very few of them regard themselves as political activists in any way. You know, I think that they are upbeat and positive because they do see this as part of a project to build women's baseball. And, you know, they're not angry, disgruntled women. They're upbeat about the inevitability of the younger ones taking it a step further than the older ones were able to. But the older ones, you know, in just not doubting their athletic ability And, you know, that said, I should also say that, yeah, they don't doubt their athletic ability, which is extraordinary because, you know, I have seen personally through my daughter and now talk to quite a number of the women who play that level baseball. And there's always these moments when all of them at one point or another have faced some sort of rejection trying to play baseball with men and the frustration of trying to find a team of women who are as good as they are to, you know, play competitively. And the strength not to internalize that message that you're just not good enough to play with the boys is brutal. You know, I mean, so it really takes some overcoming to be able to own your own confidence and your ability when at some point or another, every single one of these girls and women has been told, you're not good enough. You know, what makes you think you can play with boys?
So you said you didn't want to write a depressing book, but I'll finish with a depressing question for you. So what happened to your Oakland A's this year?
God. Yeah, that's depressing.
You've been listening to an interview with Jennifer Ring about her book, Stolen Bases, Why American Girls Don't Play Baseball, published in 2009 by the University of Illinois Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from public policy to religion. If you like what you heard here, please subscribe to New Books in Sports at the iTunes Store and link to us at our Facebook page. My name is Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening and enjoy your week.